We all need to get a better handle on how to deal with daily frustrations in our lives, things that cause us anger or overreaction. Happens to all of us. I got online to look at what angers most Americans, and every list is very similar. And there are things that rose to the top of the list, and if you, these don't bother you, you are the exception and not the general rule. For instance, waiting on people who are never on time. That bother anybody in here? Is she sitting next to you, fellas? How about being stuck in traffic? That bother anybody? Okay. Slow restaurant service. That never gets to you, does it? Busy parking lots. All of us have a trigger, a button to be pushed, and all of us have something that causes us to lose control and act so unlike God and how Jesus would act in the same situation. I just spent a week with my older brother, the revival. He led the singing, and we're night and day, me and him, but just a year apart, almost exactly a year. And I know what happened. Mom and Dad, after living with him for a few months, thought, we can do better than this, and there I came. So anyway, we were reminiscing about things when we were little, and when we were in middle school, he got his first girlfriend, and her name was Teresa Honey. How about that for a name? Teresa Honey. And he'd start calling her on the phone, and I'd sneak up to Mom and Dad's bedroom, and I'd get on the other phone, and I would listen to him talk to Teresa Honey. And then one night, I heard my older brother Mike say, Teresa, you're my honey. So mushy. I couldn't help but laugh because my brother doesn't talk like that, and I forgot I was on the phone. And then I hear him say, Teresa, hang on a second. Click. And then he runs up the stairs, he grabs me, he drags me into the shower, turns the water on, I got my clothes on, and there I sit. But you know what, I got to tell you, after all these years, it was so worth it. I knew I was in trouble. It's one of my favorite children's books of all time. I can relate to this younger brother of Anthony. It's called I'll Fix Anthony, written from the perspective of his younger brother, and I can relate again. He says, my brother Anthony can read now, but he won't read any books to me. He plays checkers with Bruce from school. But when I ask, he yells, go away or I'll clobber you. Mother says, deep down in his heart, Anthony loves me. Anthony says, deep down in his heart, he thinks I stink. Mother says, deep down in his heart, Anthony loves me, and he doesn't even know it. Anthony says, deep down in his heart, he still thinks I stink. When I'm six, I'll fix Anthony. When I'm six, I'll float on the water, but Anthony, he'll sink to the bottom. I'll breathe in and out like you should, and Anthony will go bloop, 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 bloop. When I'm six, my teeth will fall out, and I'll put them under my pillow, and the tooth fairy will take them away and leave me quarters. Anthony's teeth won't fall out. He'll wiggle and wiggle and wiggle, but they won't fall out. I might sell him one of my teeth, but I might not. Anthony is chasing me out of the playroom. He says I stink. He says he's going to clobber me, so I have to run now. But I won't have to run when I'm six. When I'm six, I'll fix Anthony. It's interesting. The number one thing that brings tension and frustration into your life, do you know what it is? It's relationships. Irony. The number one thing that brings joy and happiness and love into your life, it's relationships. The very thing that pumps you up and makes you feel worthwhile is the very thing that can bring you down and make you feel worthless. It's amazing, really. I found a little video, sent it to one of my preacher buddies that kind of illustrates that point. So check this out.
It's just, there's all this pressure, you know? And sometimes it feels like it's right up on me and I can just feel it, like literally feel it in my head, and it's relentless. And I don't know if it's gonna stop. I mean, that's the thing that scares me the most, is that I don't know if it's ever gonna stop.
Yeah. Well, you do have a nail in your head.
It is not about the nail.
Are you sure? Because, I mean, I'll bet if we got that out of there...
Stop trying to fix it.
No, I'm not trying to fix it. I'm just pointing out that maybe the nail is causing...
You always do this. You always try to fix things when what I really need is for you to just listen.
No, see, I don't... I think that is what you need. I think what you need is to get the nail
out. See, you're not even listening now.
Okay, fine. I will listen. Fine.
It's just, sometimes it's like, there's this achy, I don't know what it is. And I'm not sleeping very well at all. And all my sweaters are snagged. I mean, all of them.
That sounds really hard.
It is. Thank you.
Ow!
Oh, come on! Ow. If you would just...
Don't! Try to see things my
way. I don't know if you can hear it very well. My favorite part is when it says, all my sweaters are snagged. Today I want to look at a story that involves a familiar name and one you probably know nothing about. The familiar name is David, and before he became king, he was a mercenary warrior. And the story shows how tension can develop over nothing between two hotheads. It's kind of a lengthy passage. I want to read it, and then I'll break it down for you what's going on, and we'll make a couple of practical points. There was a wealthy man from Maon who owned property near the town of Carmel. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. It was sheep shearing time. This man's name was Nabal, and his wife Abigail was a sensible and beautiful woman. But Nabal, a descendant of Caleb, was crude and mean in all his dealings. When David heard that Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent 10 of his young men to Carmel with this message for Nabal. Peace and prosperity to you, your family, everything you own. I'm told that it's sheep shearing time. While your shepherds stayed among us near Carmel, we never harmed them, and nothing was ever stolen from them. Ask your own men, and they'll tell you this is true. So would you be kind to us, since we've come at a time of celebration, share provisions you might have on hand with us and with your friend David. David's young men gave this message to Nabal in David's name, and they waited for a reply. Who is this fellow David? Nabal sneered to the young men. Who does this son of Jesse think he is? There are lots of servants these days who run away from their masters. Should I take my bread and my water and my meat that I've slaughtered from my shears and give it to a band of outlaws who come from who knows where? So David's young men returned and told him what Nabal had said. Here's David's reply. Get your swords, was David's reply as he strapped on his own. Then 400 men started off with David and 200 remained behind to guard their equipment. Now, what we're not going to read is the rest of the story where he takes off and he's going to slaughter Nabal and his family because they won't give him any food. But Abigail, Nabal's wife, has the ladies in town bake some cakes and bring them out to David when Nabal doesn't know about it. And then she tells Nabal later, and he ain't happy. He gets drunk and has a heart attack, and 10 days later he dies. It's a cool story. Now, I know it's too much to take in, so I broke it down for you. I did all the work. All you have to do is pay attention. It goes like this. After the death of Samuel, David moves to the region of Paran. David and his troops have provided security for the people in that region, so they're helping them out. David and his men need food, send representative to a wealthy man named Nabal looking for some help. The Bible describes Nabal as a mean, cruel, stubborn man. His own wife says he lives up to his name. David asked for food from Nabal in return for the kindness of protecting him and his family. Nabal's a very wealthy man, could easily afford the food. But in his typical smart-aleck way, he denies David's request. David is prepared to wipe him and his family out, but then Abigail comes with food and begs David to spare them. David, unlike Nabal, listens to reason and spares Nabal's family. Later, when Nabal is dealing with a hangover after getting sauced, his wife tells him what she did. He then has a heart attack and dies 10 days later. Now, I'll come back to that story. Social scientists tell us there are 5 levels of anger, and it appears to me David started at 4 and went to 5 pretty quick. Level 1 is irritation. That's like a baby crying on an airplane or a sermon going too long. How many of you have ever experienced that? Let me see hands. Oh, you've all flown, huh? That's cool. Level 2 is indignation. That's where a referee makes a bad call that costs your team the game. You can't deal with it. I experience that often. Level 3, wrath. Every news story bothers your sense of justice. It kicks in and you have an opinion about how everyone needs to be punished. Level 4 is fury, and some of you have gotten to that point. You snap and you do something you regret forever. And then the highest level is number 5, and that's rage. That's where brutal acts of violence occur or responses that change your life forever. You know why anger is our favorite response? For 2 reasons. It always shows itself, and you want the people around you to know how you feel, so you'll let them see anger. It just shows itself, and you like that. And secondly, it gets immediate attention, whereas other emotions do not. I read this week, on average in the United States, 3 to 5 men are killed by vending machines every year. Why is that? because they put their 50 cents in and couldn't get their honey bun out, and they start shaking that bad boy until it falls on them. 3 to 5 men. There is now not only road rage, there is the clinical discussion of appliance rage. Anybody experience that? I'm not talking about you fellas whose wives are throwing toasters at you. That's not what we're talking about. It was Guy Booz who was arrested for disturbing the peace when he was having trouble with his refrigerator and threw it down 3 flights of stairs. And then to add style points, took his handgun and shot it 3 times. You got appliance rage and road rage? If you fly very often, you know about air rage, right? Close quarters create some tense moments. I love my family till I travel with them. Close quarters create some tense moments. Frank Lawson boarded a plane in L.A. headed for New York. A stop in Dallas, which he needed to get off in Dallas because he had business, and he told the flight attendant, "I am a sound sleeper on an airplane." He said, "When this plane stops in Dallas, I'll sleep right through the stop. You need to get me off this plane. You do whatever it takes. You have to pick me up and throw me off this plane. You do it. I can't miss this meeting in Dallas." Well, Frank Lawson woke up as the plane was landing in New York, and he went into a rage, and he read that flight attendant the riot act and stomped off the plane, and the worker didn't say anything, but when Frank left, the pilot said, "Have you ever seen someone so mad in all your life?" And the flight attendant said, "I have. You should have seen the man I threw off the plane in Dallas." Every one of us has a capacity to overreact. I've always said this: the ends never justify the meanness. And the scariest thing about anger is we always feel justified. Well, I put my money in that vending machine. Well, I was first in line. I interviewed better than he did. Well, I have a deed that shows my property line goes right here, and he built a fence on it. You feel justified. It makes it dangerous, and this has always been true. So I look at David's response to Nabal, refusing to give him food and drink, and I come up with 3 or 4 things to consider when you feel your temperature rising. This is kind of a personal sermon to me, too, although I don't lose my cool very often, but it can happen. Number one, we need to reveal the source of our resentment. I'm not a counselor, but this is where all counseling begins. Why are you hurt? Why do you feel the way you do? Why are you so angry? Sam Pratt's a guy from Rising Sun I knew for years and years. The angriest man I ever knew was Sam Pratt, and he didn't even know why he was angry. And you know what people who knew Sam would say to me? "Oh, Mark, that's just Sam. He's just temperamental." Well, let me define for you temperamental. Temperamental is 95% temper and 5% mental. My grandsons are into superheroes. I visited with them yesterday, and they always ask me, "Poppy, who's your favorite superhero?" Never been any doubt. He's always been my favorite superhero. That dude right there. The Incredible Hulk. One of the greatest movie quotes of all time is Bruce Banner. He said, "I don't know who I am. I don't know what I'm becoming, but I know one thing for sure. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry." It's important to distinguish between righteous anger and the anger you generally feel, because that's not righteous. Somebody tell me how many times anger is mentioned in the Bible, and I will buy your lunch today, tomorrow, and the day after. See how fast you can Google, right? How many times is anger mentioned in the Bible? Nobody's even going to guess for free lunch 3 days in a row? But close enough to make me look. 578 times anger is mentioned in the Bible. Now, if you can tell me how many times it refers to man's anger, I'll buy your lunch 3 days in a row too. Of the 578, how many times refer to man's anger versus God's? You should have stayed with your first guess, Angie. We were close then. 50. 50 of the 578 refer to me and you getting angry. By my VV Indiana math, then, 578 minus 50 for you and me leaves 528 times the Bible talks about the anger of God. Lots of verses, a couple that have always grabbed my attention. Romans 1, the wrath of God, the anger of God is revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And this passage, when I was a teenager, got my attention. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, He will punish those who do not know God and do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. They will be punished with everlasting destruction and shut out from the presence of the Lord and from the majesty of his power. And then Jesus, while he was here on earth, everybody wants to talk about his love and grace and mercy, which we should always highlight. But mercy's sakes, there were times when he got angry and upset and plain old ticked off. Walking into the temple, seeing people getting cheated on their way to worship, he turned tables over, he made whips, he drove them out with whips, and he got angry. And if we're going to be like Jesus, that means there are times where we have to be angry. In the modern day church, you won't find anyone talking about the anger of God. We want a heavenly pal or a user-friendly God or a non-judgmental God. And so people make biblically indefensible statements that drive me nuts, like, well, the God I know would never allow anyone to go to hell. Really? I mean, I know God is love and God is grace and God is mercy, and I'll preach that till I'm blue in the face. He forgives, he forgets, but never dismiss this angry side of him, because if you do, you create the picture of a God I've never met. And if I'm going to be like Jesus, that means there are times where it's going to have to get my dander up, and I made a list of things that tick me off. I'll share a few. My tax dollars that help fund the National Endowment of Arts, who then take my money and your money and exhibit blasphemous portraits of Jesus in ungodly situations. That upsets me. The condom crusade promoted by many in government and education with the message that kids should engage themselves in safe sex. That is so short-sighted and defeatist when the Bible describes safe sex and never uses the word condom. Always uses the word abstinence. There's a word for every teenager in every church, and they should become acquainted with it. To abstain until the time is right, the situation is right, the person is right, and God says it's right. Being safe will never be a high enough standard for a Christian. Ticks me off. The lack of respect for the sanctity of life. I'll joke about everything in the world. I'll never joke about that. Elderly people who are shoved to the corner, the unborn, we'll talk about that next week, the evil mind of a terrorist who blows up buildings with people in it, it's a slap in the face of God, ticks me off. The dismantlement of biblical marriage and the rise of same-sex marriage upsets this preacher. It's an assault on the biblical structure of family and value and leaves our kids confused and apathetic toward what God wants and his plan, and it ticks me off. I could go all day on things that tick me off, and there should be a list for you too. Because if we were angry about these things and not the trivial things like the color of carpet or will there be pews or chairs, if we were angry about these things, then our collective voice of disapproval might be heard. It was Aristotle who said, a person who's angry on the right grounds against the right person in the right manner for the right amount of time deserves great praise. Secondly, this story of David, and we'll get back to it before we close, shows me that I need to reflect before I react. Reflect before you react. The Proverb 29:11 describes every person. So you're one or the other. A fool gives full vent to his anger, but a wise man keeps himself under control. Now you're in that verse. So you to yourself think, okay, I'm more like that than this. You're either a fool who just lets it fly, or you're a wise man who keeps himself under control. Another way to say that people who fly into a rage rarely make a good landing. Man, do I need to learn this, to reflect before I react. If I could just gather myself and say, now, Mark, if you say that, that's going to lead to this, and it's going to go downhill real quick. Now, Mark, if you do that, you won't be able to take that back, and it's not going to help. And if I could just reflect before I react. Ralph Melton wishes he had. He's asleep in bed on a Saturday morning. True story. It's the only time he gets to sleep in. And he's woke from his sleep from a noise on his roof. Well, he ain't happy at all. About 5 in the morning, he goes out and he sees a woodpecker pounding away on a TV antenna. Just pounding his little bird brains out on that metal pole. And Ralph's out there in his pajamas and he's ticked off and he picks up a rock and he throws it at the woodpecker and he misses. And it goes over the house, through the passenger side window of his new truck. Well, that helped, didn't it? Now he's really ticked. Forgetting that he has no shoes on, he kicks at the dirt. Hits a dirt clod, breaks 2 toes on his right foot. About 6 weeks later, infection sets into his bloodstream. And then a couple of weeks after that, 8 weeks after throwing a rock at a woodpecker that woke him up on a Saturday morning, Ralph Melton died. Reflecting before you react probably could have saved his life. Now, here's another thought, and I need to learn this one too. Restrain your remarks. I was with my mom and dad all week. They're a hoot, and I got to tell story after story about them. My dad, against his better judgment, once went to the supermarket with my mom. In my mom's words, "Logan, they're running specials." And he said, "Well, we don't need anything." She said, "It doesn't matter. We buy because they're running specials." So she talked him into going with her. They go to the supermarket, and he sits in the car, but she's taking too long. So dad goes in and starts shopping around and looking for specials. So I want to be clear. My folks, to my knowledge, have never had a drink. I've never seen them drink. If they do, they've always done it in the closet apart from us boys. Never seen him drink. So my dad picks up 4 bottles of wine and puts them in his cart and walks by my mom so she can see it. And she looks and sees the wine and she says, "What are you doing? We don't drink." He said, "I know, but they're on sale. 4 bottles for $15. A few aisles and many minutes later, he sees mom pick up a $30 jar of face cream and puts it in the cart. And he says, "What are you doing?" She said, "It's for my face. It makes me look beautiful." This is the point at which my dad should have zipped his lips, but he couldn't help himself. He said, "Makes you look beautiful. So does 4 bottles of wine, but it's half the price." He never knew what hit him. Next thing you hear is the announcer on the PA saying, "Clean up on aisle 7. We have a husband down." You know, it's easy for us to just shoot off a remark. It's no wonder the Bible emphasized the power of the tongue. The spectrum, the verbal spectrum we involve ourselves. You know, I could say something that uplifts somebody and encourages them and literally gets them through the week. But in a moment of frustration on my part, I could say something that puts them in a hole they can't dig out of for the next month. Literally changes their outlook and their attitude. It's the most practical book in the Bible and the most practical passage. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. Leave that up for a second, Rox. Everyone, there's no wiggle room here, right? Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become. Everyone, is that you, Gary? Are you everyone? Is that you, Stacy? Are you everyone? Sarah, you everyone? Jay, you everyone? Everyone, everyone. You, your grandma, your Aunt Hattie in Minneapolis, who you don't visit. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to be. We do the exact opposite of that verse. We are slow to listen. We are quick to speak. And we are quick to becoming angry. Listen. You need to release the source of your resentment, reflect before you react, restrain your remarks, and one last one that'll take me back to David and Nabal. You need to release your desire to retaliate. This is a challenge. Leonardo da Vinci painted what you and I know as the Last Supper, and he had a vision for the painting. Da Vinci had an enemy that he could not stand, and he decided to paint his enemy's face on the body of Judas Iscariot. That was going to be his way of getting back. But as he looked at his painting, he was convicted because he saw, you know, this is a message of love and forgiveness, and it made him feel bad. So he removed the face of his enemy on the body of Judas, and most believe he put his own face on the body of Judas Iscariot. Abraham Lincoln, one of the greatest presidents in our history, said when he had an issue with a fellow politician or an attorney, he would write down everything he thought about that person and write a mean-spirited letter to them, including nasty language, ugliness, and when he got it all off his chest in writing, he'd wad it up and throw it in the fireplace and then write a complimentary letter to the person he had an issue with. Well, my leader, your leader, Jesus Christ, said, "Settle matters quickly." So here comes David and his 600 mighty men on their horses, and they've got one objective. They're going to kill Nabal and everyone associated with him. So Abigail, Nabal's wife, when Nabal doesn't know about it, she gets the ladies in the town to bake some cakes. And they bring some cakes out to David. proving what you women already know, the way to a man's heart is through what? Through his stomach. So David and his men eat some cake, and David's response, it kind of cracks me up. 1 Samuel 25, verse 32, check it out. David replied to Abigail, "Praise the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you to meet me today. Thank God for your good sense. Bless you for keeping me from murder and carrying out vengeance with my own hands. For I swear by the Lord, the God of Israel, who has kept me from hurting you, that if you had not hurried out to meet me, not one of Nabal's men would still be alive tomorrow morning." Then David accepted the present and told her, "Return home in peace. I've heard what you said. We will not kill your husband." How about that? What's the hardest thing that God ever asked us to do? Anybody have an answer to that? Forgive other people, right? Hardest thing God has ever asked any one of us to do. Hard for me. So I need to be reminded when I look at the cross exactly how much it cost God and what length he was willing to go to forgive me. Now, I don't know about you, but when somebody does me wrong and hurts me or damages me or hurts my kids, or it's so hard. It's so hard to forgive and to get rid of that. But man, if you will pray and ask God to fill your heart with his love and his peace, it's more than just letting it go. You literally have to send it away. And then you know what happens, right? You see that person again and all those old feelings began to come back, and all of a sudden, what was gone is there again. Can I tell you the hardest person for me through the years to forgive in the church? It's always been your preacher. That's the one that's hardest for me to forgive. But then I'll read verses about God's mercy and his grace, and I'll get to the point where I can even get rid of that, the way I feel about myself, and I'll let that go. But then I'll look in the mirror, or I'll do something right after I had repented, or I'll try to be better, and all of a sudden, I'm right back to where I was before. You know, it's more than just letting it go. It really is sending it away. Years ago, I asked a question to my church, and I wanted written responses, and I got dozens of responses to this question. The question was, Rox, will you put it up there for me? What hurtful thing has been said to you that you struggle to forgive? And people wrote down responses and gave them to me. I thought it would be a cool exercise. It broke my heart. Almost wish I'd have never asked. So we gathered up all the responses, and I took my church staff away to a camp setting to where we had a retreat. And we prayed over these all day long, that God would heal hearts and fix people. Listen to some of these things that people said. What hurtful thing has been said to you that you struggle to forgive? You'd be doing us all a favor if you'd just go ahead and commit suicide. I wish you'd never been born. I wish I'd never met you. I never truly loved you, no matter what you thought. You're a failure at everything you do, and you always will be. If you died tonight, nothing would be different for me tomorrow. You turned out to be my biggest disappointment in life. And then when I read these, I had teenage kids, and this one, when I was a teenager, my dad told me I wasn't smart enough to go to college or pretty enough to keep a man from cheating on me. Hard, isn't it? Hard. But you know what you have to do? You have to do more than just say, well, I'm just going to let that go. You let that go, it'll stay right there. You have to do more than that. You have to be proactive. So, here's a biblical picture of forgiveness right here. Let's say it's somebody in your family that has hurt you. Maybe it's a spouse or an ex-spouse or a mother or a father or a child or a grandfather. What you have to do is pray about it, take it to God, ask him to fill your heart with his love and his mercy, and you know what? I can't totally forget about it, but guess what I can do? I can put it in the trash and watch the trash get put in the dumpster and be taken away. And then it'll come back. And it may not be in the form of a family member. It might be, but it might be just a friend who has lied about you or cheated on you or stolen from you or took you for granted or gossiped about you. And you're thinking, man, I cannot let this go. No, you can't let it go, but you can forgive them. You can send it away. You can throw it in the trash and watch the trash be put in the dumpster and the dumpster be taken away. And then it comes back. I have trash in my house every day. And this time it might not be a family member or a friend. It might be somebody in your church who should know better. Somebody in your church who should be showing you the grace and love and forgiveness that God Almighty has shown them. And you can't find it in your heart to let it go. So you pray and ask God to fill your heart with love and forgiveness and mercy. And you just throw it in the trash. Every day at our house, we take out the trash. Every day. And the next day, there'll be more trash. And I'll have to take it out again. Whoever told you that to forgive someone means you forget about it, you never think about it again, you never deal with it again. They sold you a bill of goods. I can't do that. But mercy sakes, I can send it away. And if it comes back again, I'll send it away again. Anger and bitterness is an acid that does more harm to the cup in which it's stored than the harm it does the vessel in which it's poured. Listen, let me give you a biblical definition of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not a one and done kind of experience. It's a daily taking out of the trash. And forgiveness is not so much about letting things go. It's more about sending them away. It took me a long time to learn that God's not the enemy, my enemies. I kind of thought he was. And then I realized God's not even the enemy of his enemies. So how stupid was that? And whenever I feel hurt or treated bad or uncared for, I'm reminded of Psalm 86:15. God is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in love. And I'm thankful that he is. And that's who I want to be like when I feel my temperature rising. Amen.